So, Jay, what's on your mind?
Ah, Miles, I've just been thinking about better times. Remember when Storm and Callisto had their hardcore frenemies thing going?
You mean the time Storm stabbed Callisto in the heart?
Yeah, but then they teamed up to take on Kulan Goth.
Man, Storm is stone cold.
Psh, you think a little stabbing is impressive? Miles, one time Storm straight up tore Marrow's heart out of her chest.
For leadership of the Morlocks?
Nah, there was a time bomb wired to it.
You'd think they could have come up with a less violent solution.
It's cool. Marrow had another.
Bomb?
Heart.
What?!
I'm Jay Edidin.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 203 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, outs, and retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera. Look, some days are better than others for the X-Men, and I want to say up front, this is going to be a rough one, kids.
It is. It's not one of my favorite stories, it's true, but I will say there's a light at the end of the tunnel, because at this point, we are finally on to sort of the end of the transitional era of X-Men. We've had all these image creators that were doing their thing, a lot of scripting and plotting being broken down between artists and writers, or writers and artists, I should say. Things are going to get a little less chaotic, and then we get Executioner's Song, and then we get into the part of the 90s that feels a lot more consistent.
Which isn't to say that what we're looking at today is all bad. For instance, Warren Kenneth Worthington III gets yelled at pretty hard, and we're always in favor of that.
We totally are. So, today we're going to be covering Uncanny X-Men number 291 to 293. It's a nice little arc about some Morlocks and some questionable stuff, and I suppose we should give a surprising amount of background information.
All right, you want to say it, Miles?
Previously on X-Men.
The X-Men are split into two teams. Blue Team has been headlining Adjectiveless X-Men, while Gold Team is leading up Uncanny X-Men. And the Gold Team these days consists of a lot of the less flashy characters: Storm, Jean Grey, Colossus, Iceman, and Archangel, and most recently, Bishop.
Right, Bishop is a mutant cop from a dark future who's now stuck in the present and who's gradually learning to be less murdery. Slightly less murdery.
Now, a while back, Gold Team briefly traveled to an alternate dimension where they discovered Colossus's brother, believed to be dead, who had in fact been trapped there for years.
That is Mikhail Rasputin, who has these sort of ill-defined reality-warping powers, and who also got pretty messed up after he accidentally killed all of his buds in that dimension while attempting to save it.
Now Mikhail is back in Earth 616, staying with the X-Men while he gradually recovers, and occasionally having dissociative episodes where he turns skateboarders into trees.
You turn one skateboarder into a tree one time and nobody ever lets you forget it. Come on, Jay.
Look, man, I don't make the rules.
Yeah, that's fair. Meanwhile, the Morlocks, those are the outcast mutants living in the tunnels under New York City who have been around forever, they've been in a state of chaos for quite a while.
In the Morlocks' first appearance in an X-Book, Storm dueled their leader Callisto and won, giving Storm official leadership of the Morlocks, whom she subsequently mostly ignored.
A bit later, in the Mutant Massacre, that's the first X-Men crossover, most of the Morlocks were killed by the Marauders. At the time, Angel also got impaled to a wall by his wings, which led to him having those wings amputated and eventually being transformed into Archangel by Apocalypse, complete with new, sharp, metal, evil wings.
Well, technically Apocalypse transformed him into the Horseman Death, and after he shook off Apocalypse's influence, Beast renamed him Archangel.
Good point, good point.
It's good to be precise about these kinds of things. Since that time, the de facto leader of the Morlocks has become Mask, who is a big jerk. Mask tracked down Callisto and used his body-altering powers to make her prettier. No longer slightly less attractive than most comics characters, she left the tunnels and hooked up with the, at the time, memoryless Colossus.
Colossus got his memories back and rejoined the X-Men, but we haven't really seen much of Callisto since then. We have, however, seen Mask. He attacked X-Force along with the new Brotherhood of Evil Mutants and got very thoroughly shot by Cable. He's dead. For now.
Now, there are two things that I think are worth bringing up about the period of time when Colossus and Callisto were together. The first is that Colossus at that point believed himself to be and was living as an American painter named Peter Nicholas. This was after he'd gone through the Siege Perilous and had his memory rewritten. Second, Callisto was extremely unhappy with her transformation. She didn't like the pretty thing. She didn't like losing her physical edge, which apparently left along with her new form. So all she wanted was to have her old body and her old life back. And that's going to be relevant because by the time this issue comes out, everyone involved in its creation will have forgotten it.
So those are two very important things, Jay. I agree. There was a third important thing from that era, which is that Colossus, as Peter Nicholas, had a great fucking ponytail. And I miss it.
Okay, yeah, it was a good ponytail.
Right?
So let's jump into the story. And actually, no, let's not yet jump into the story, because I want to qualify before we start that this whole arc has a really intense Rudyard Kipling at his worst vibe to it.
You know, I didn't catch that until you mentioned it, but yeah, you're totally right. You were comparing it to The White Man's Burden, right?
Right. This is basically the X-Man's Burden. Can't you, like, imagine Professor Xavier just randomly stuck into his dialogue somewhere here, calling the Morlocks half devil and half child?
I mean, yeah, especially the way they're portrayed in this arc.
Yeah. I believe this is one of LaBelle's first Uncanny X-Men issues where he's credited fully as writer, not just as scripter. And we've also got a new artist on here. We've got Tom Rainey as the guest penciler. And boy, howdy. I'm not a fan. I am super not a fan.
I go back and forth. I mean, 90s X-Men has a certain house style, and I think Rainey gets it pretty well. I do really like his Callisto later on, after she's transformed back to her original appearance. But then you have other panels like Jean Grey being bent almost completely in half while she's flying through the air, so I don't know.
It's not his draftsmanship that I object to, although that comes and goes. It's 90% of his creative choices involving female characters. And I'll get to this further, but for a great intersection of fucked up, let's start by judging this book by its cover, because goddamn.
How would you describe this cover, Jay?
Okay, so the cover is dominated by two distinct figures. Storm in the front, looking elegant and desperate and, you know, windswept. Attacking her is a monstrous black woman with dreads and much more distinctly black features, who is looking super out of control and monstery and zombie-ish. Which, first of all, you made some choices there. Like, I feel like at this point I don't really need to explain why this is a problem to stick on your cover, especially when that other character doesn't actually appear in the comic, as far as I can tell.
So at first I figured, hey, there's a group of people attacking Storm and they're not all default white and that's a good thing. But then
the result is actually just super fucking racist, which that's easily avoidable. There are also a bunch of random ass Morlocks sort of wedged in and like whose heads are floating in the space around them, all of whom are colored randomly bright colors and one of whom appears to be Swamp Thing. And yeah, I don't know what's going on with this cover. This is the parts that aren't actively and intensely racist are arbitrary and poorly drawn. So I think this one's kind of a write-off.
Well, thankfully, the cover to the next issue is actually one of my favorites, but we'll get to that later. What we should get to now is what happens.
You know, the whole you can't judge a book by its cover thing?
Sure.
Sometimes you can judge a book by its cover, because the first page of this comic, and I thought, you know, it can't be as bad as the cover. The first page is Colossus catching what the text describes as a badly beaten Callisto, who is about as sexualized as a lady can be in an illustration.
Yeah, and as a reminder, Callisto was transformed into a very conventionally attractive woman by Mask in a previous story arc, and so that's what we get here, but she's, yeah, really sexily heavily injured, and that's strange.
Not in comics, it's not strange. I've talked about this on the show before, and it's one of my least favorite tropes in comics, which is sexy, dead, or severely injured women. This goes with the general trope and the general weird artistic dogma that women in comics have to look really pretty and really sexy all the time. And so you end up with some bizarre stuff and a lot of broken back posing and a lot of fight scenes where the ways that the male characters move is really aggressive and the ways the female characters move is just sort of bizarre. And, you get my absolute least favorite occurrence of that, which is when you have a character, a female character, who's supposed to be severely physically injured or dead, who is super sexified up in that, which just is an extra gross expression of that particular trope. And boy, does Rainey lean into it in this issue.
Well, that's distasteful, but we do get some pretty glorious dialogue as the team assembles and Iceman, ice sliding in, says,
"Why does it always feel like I've walked in on the third reel of a movie?" To which Bishop rejoins,
"Perhaps, Iceman, because you spend more time perfecting one-liners and less on preparing yourself for any eventuality. You'd last about 5 seconds in the XSE."
Bishop, we're not in the XSE. This is no longer Kansas, buddy.
And yet, while most of the X-Men are in their pajamas watching Jay Leno, he apparently had a shotgun very nearby, which, yeah, actually, I totally buy that. He totally would all the time.
We also get the opportunity to see what Gold Team wears around the house and how they react to crises showing up at their literal door, which gives us some pretty delightful involuntary slapstick. First of all, not counting Archangel, who apparently hangs out in his horseman bodysuit at all times, Professor X is the only dude in the mansion who wears a shirt at home.
Okay, to be fair, if I had an outfit designed by Walter Simonson, even if it had been given to me by my tormentor Apocalypse, I would still wear it all the time because it looks fucking rad.
I bet it gets pretty gross, though.
Yeah, that's true. Do you think he has multiples? Do you think Apocalypse, like, actually gave him a change of it so on laundry day he doesn't have to wear something else so he can always stay on brand and represent the company identity?
Or that it's somehow, like, self-cleaning?
I'm gonna go with self-cleaning. Let's just say unstable molecules. That explains pretty much everything as far as costumes.
Do you think it also cleans him?
Yeah. And honestly, if we extend this further, he probably doesn't have to go anywhere when he has to use the bathroom. He just thinks about it and the suit takes care of it. Maybe it, like, turns that into flechettes. Ew, those flechettes got a lot grosser. I don't like this theory, but I know it to be true.
Well, that took an abrupt and upsetting turn. Now, among the topless gents in the house are Mikhail, who is upstairs in bed hallucinating the comrades he got killed in another dimension. And yeah, Bishop carries an enormous fucking shotgun at all times, and also does not have an inside voice.
Of course, it's Lucas Bishop. In the future, everyone's hearing is heavily damaged by how very post-apocalyptic it is, so you just have to yell all the time or nobody can hear you.
What if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy and their hearing is just damaged by how much everyone else yells all the time?
Earth 1191, I am so sorry. Your future is very, very sad, but I guess at least everybody has sweet mullets, so there's that.
Yeah, it's got something going for it. And so many guns, which actually isn't a plus at all, so screw that future.
Yeah, pretty much. So, as usual in a Marvel comic book, whenever a past event is referenced, in this case, when Callisto got turned into a conventionally attractive woman by Mask, we get a little caption telling us when it was. In this case, it says,
"We don't remember exactly when, but trust us, it happened."
Oh, Bob Harris, it was around, like, Uncanny 259 and 260. Editors, this is, like, your job. This is almost as bad as the note when Warhawk showed up in Adjectiveless X-Men number 10. And, like, later they pick the wrong issue to reference when Bishop sees a radiation sign in the tunnels. And I'm just saying, like, I know it's our job to fixate on these things, but it is also the job of ex-editors to fixate on these things. And they probably get paid a lot more than we do.
I will, speaking of the characters here, though, there's one thing that I will give Tom Rainey. I really like his Professor X.
I think his Professor X from this arc may be my iconic early 90s Professor X. Like, when I think of Xavier from the comics, this is the one I think of from this era.
Most of the other characters aren't, but Rainey's Professor X is very, very Barry Windsor Smith.
Yeah, you are not wrong.
Now, along with Callisto has come the Morlock's healer. This is the guy who we have called the Sewer Wizard.
I love the Sewer Wizard. Like, I mean, he's got the skull cap and the robes and the beard, and he's got a bunch of slots of fireball, and he's got a necklace of polymorph, and he's got a little cat familiar, probably. I love that guy.
And he'll cure what ails you and dress you up in fancy leather pants.
I mean, how else do you cure someone?
I don't know. This is basically the bit we did on Magic Tavern.
That was really fun.
That was super fun.
Anyway.
They get rushed to the infirmary where Callisto continues to be situation inappropriately sexy. And through a mind link with Callisto, the professor learns what happened. Specifically, things went south when the Morlocks, led by the healer, showed up at Callisto's apartment to enlist her leadership because they've been falling apart after extensive mismanagement. And Callisto, sometime between her last appearance and this, has had a significant turn of heart, because when the Morlocks appeared, Callisto, who had been their dedicated leader, who wanted nothing but to get her physical prowess back, to feel like herself again, blows them off because she's pretty and she doesn't need them anymore.
That doesn't feel like Callisto at all.
I 100% do not buy this. This is ridiculous, and it's bad writing, and it's bad characterization, and I'm just going to go ahead and assume it's Mystique.
That seems very likely. On the upside, and this is a long, long time in the future, but when Callisto goes back to leading a new group of Morlocks in the ongoing Storm series from a couple years ago by Greg Pak, she is exactly the Callisto that I want her to be. So let's just consider this a misstep along the way.
She also gave Shadowcat a pretty good shovel talk in one of the myriad pre-marriage issues of, I believe, X-Men Gold.
Yup.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the Morlocks here, because they're really different from what we've seen before. These Morlocks are extremely childish. They're extremely simplistic, and they're no longer really distinct characters, even visually.
This is something that I first noticed when Liefeld started drawing New Mutants and the Morlocks were somewhat regularly recurring characters. They were just sort of these big, beefy monsters. A lot of them reminded me of the Abomination from the Hulk, actually, just different takes on that basic design. And it seems like that's what's continued here. And that's unfortunate, because way back in the day, like when the Morlocks were new around the Mutant Massacre, we had these really distinctive characters. We had, you know, Annalee, and we had Sunder, and they were really awesome.
And Urg. I really like Urg.
Urg was super awesome, yeah. And to be fair, many of those characters were indeed killed in the Mutant Massacre or thereafter, but it seems like the only Morlocks left were the kind of boring ones.
They're all sort of one palette swapped lumpy person, and none of them are capable of any degree of self-determination, which is something I have a really big problem with. The X-Men's relationship to the Morlocks has always been kind of awkward, but self-determination has always been incredibly important to the Morlocks. It's always been central to their identity as a group. It's always been central. It's been the central reason that they chose to live as a group in the sewers. And reducing them to this state, making them incapable of any degree of self-management or self-determination, is, you know, I mentioned this feeling super Kiplingy, and Professor X emerges from the mind meld and immediately decides that it is the X-Men's job to save the Morlocks from themselves.
Yup. Now, Mikhail Rasputin disagrees. He's decided that Callisto is sort of a kindred spirit, and for ill-defined reasons that have to do with his ill-defined mutant powers, he was in on the mind link.
Oh, Colossus later attributes this to an as-yet-undiscovered psychic link that exists between myself and my brother. Sure, Janet.
Storm claims responsibility for the Morlocks, which, I mean, fair enough. She is officially still their leader. But Archangel says that it's his responsibility because he lost his wings trying to defend them. And then he blames Storm for this situation.
Fuck you, Warren Kenneth Worthington III.
That being said, even if his logic is a little bit distorted, he does have a good point that much of the Morlocks' plight, as, you know, Mask turned them into this horribly dysfunctional, abused group of people, and all the other stuff that's happened, I mean, Storm did say the Morlocks were going to be her responsibility, and she even comments at one point that maybe this is a little bit her fault because she was too busy, as Forge accused her, of just paying attention only to the X-Men.
Well, what she was specifically busy doing when this stuff was going down was faking her own death.
I'm not saying that's necessarily a good excuse.
No, it just sort of drives home that failures of leadership because you were faking your own death are a pretty common recourse and logical recourse for students of Charles Xavier.
Valid point. Meanwhile, there's one death that is not faked. This makes me so sad.
And this is, we are losing our last distinctive Morlock other than Callisto, because our dear sewer wizard sacrifices his own skull-capped life to heal Callisto back to her original state, her original missing eye, wonky looks, and general bad attitude. And Callisto is really ungrateful. She is horribly upset, even though this was exactly what she wanted last time we saw her.
I mean, she forgot. She has a lot going on in her life, I guess. Anyway, everybody heads into the Morlock tunnels, including Professor X, who Jean thinks might be overcompensating for the re-loss of his ability to walk by becoming more of a field member of the team.
Now, they get past some illusory obstacles, and they discover the Morlocks, and Jean is immediately shocked.
Professor, they're destroying themselves.
Okay, Jean, let's look at the scene. Let's look at what the Morlocks on this two-page spread that is overwhelmingly dominated by the action lines from Angel's Wings, which are colored in trans pride colors, so that's cool, are doing. One Morlock is cartoonishly throttling another in just super Looney Tunes style, while a third Morlock, a much larger one, is attempting to eat what appears to be a large rock. And the rest
That's how you saw that too? I totally saw it that way.
I mean, it's a large paving stone, isn't it?
I think so, and he's really hungry and loves rocks.
So, and the rest of the Morlocks, these Morlocks who are destroying themselves, seem to be destroying themselves by standing around and looking bemused in the background of all this. And I gotta say, this scene reminds me so acutely of a page from this weird old book I had as a kid called Science Made Stupid. And there's this one point where they're talking about original views of the dinosaurs and, you know, the modern updated ones. And all of it is a bunch of vastly incorrect information, delightfully illustrated. And they're talking about how initially it was thought that the dinosaurs were cold-blooded and sluggish without much intelligence. And, you know, the updated version of them is that they may have been more like birds and spry and chipper. And in the second illustration, they're doing things like smoking pipes and writing treatises and playing badminton and stuff. And in the first one, they're just sort of draped around the landscape and one is flying head first into a cliff and others are just sort of walking off mountains and stuff.
My favorite dinosaur related thing in that book is a sort of it looks like it's one of those keys where there's a little number over each of the silhouettes.
Oh yes, those are all so good in there.
Yeah, saying that in winter the mammals grew coats with number like markings, and I don't know, it just makes me happy.
White coats with dark number like markings. The dinosaurs one is labeled, "This is what the dinosaurs would have looked like as outlines with numbers inside them."
That book is amazing. But anyway, we digress.
Yes, where were we? Right, standing around looking bemused. Now, apparently, these Morlocks, who are uncontrollably violent, because this is a new definition of uncontrollable violence with which we were previously unfamiliar, have become some kind of panicked hive mind that Professor X can't quite break through.
That's a really shitty hive mind. They could do a lot better.
Right, they could just be bees.
That would be better. They do, however, recognize Storm as their leader and immediately swamp her, demanding that she heal them, that she help them, that she save them.
Cue an immediate attack of claustrophobia.
Okay, I mean, certainly consistent with the character, that's fine. But do you remember in that one Curse of the Mutants Storm and Gambit one-shot, how Gambit asks, isn't Storm claustrophobic, when they go into some tight quarters? And she's like, well, yeah, but I've been working on it in therapy and with psychics to get over it, and now I'm doing much better. Like, seriously, I wish writers had stuck with that.
Yes, thank you. That is one of the best bits of canon that Curse of the Mutants gave us.
Right.
The best bit is obviously the time that Cyclops told Dracula to follow his heart, but...
You know, I'm a big fan of Vampire Jubilee. I was a little sad when she got devamped recently.
Yeah, no, I liked her far, far more than I expected to as well. But back to the tunnels. The tunnel also randomly seems to have gone extremely cyberpunk. Like, it's black with pink circuit lines on it now.
It's the ghost of Wills Portacio.
Honestly, that makes more sense than any other explanation that I could have thought of so far. And Storm lightnings her way out, but in doing so, everyone is shocked and horrified that she has also freed the Morlocks from the sewers.
Hey, wait a minute.
Right? I had to go back to this page like four times and read over it to make sure I was reading it correctly, because the thing is, the Morlocks weren't imprisoned in the sewers. Like, they could have just left. They could have walked out.
Okay, did you ever see that GIF online where a dog is running up to a doorway, but there's a screen door with the screen removed, so it's just the frame, and the person closes it, and then the dog waits patiently, and then the person opens the empty frame, and the dog walks through? Maybe it was kind of like that.
No, No, I think this was just bad. I think that this is all happening in an alternate stupid timeline. X-Men made stupid.
Well, that brings us to Uncanny X-Men number 292, The Mutants Take Manhattan. I personally prefer The Great Mutant Caper, but whatever. This is written by Scott Lobdell. This has layouts by Rurik Tyler, pencils by Tom Rainey, and inks by Joseph Rubinstein and Al Milgram. This cover, okay, we talked about how we didn't like the last one. I love this one. It's Jean and Storm and Colossus in the middle of a fight scene, and I can't tell what they're doing, but they all look super engaged and freaked out and angry and badass, and there's all these, like, fireworky things in the background, and I don't know what they are, but it's a really cool, colorful action shot. Like, this cover right here would totally make me pick up this issue, even if I wasn't following Uncanny.
Nice, and that is, I think, kind of the defining characteristic of a good cover.
Absolutely. So, we open with something that doesn't make a ton of sense, but does make for a hell of a set piece. We have Jean and Colossus and Bishop telekinetically flying over this stormy, flooding Manhattan, increasingly full of these monstrous Morlocks just spilling up from the ground like demons back in Inferno.
Bishop's solution to this problem, as it is to every problem, because when you've got a hammer, etc., is to shoot it. Colossus disagrees profoundly. They have a brief macho off, which Colossus wins, signifying at least a temporary victory of more constructive masculinity over violent toxic masculinity. Go Colossus.
Go Colossus indeed. There's a great big fight, but at least a slightly less murdery one than there would have been pre-Colossus telling Bishop no. Colossus fights a Morlock named Mimi. And Mimi's power is to absorb anybody he touches into his own body. So, like, there are these partial bodies just sticking out of his different body parts and faces. It is actually fucking terrifying. I remember specifically when I read this issue when I was a kid, because this was when I was buying my own comics, that this part just, I just kept looking at it like I couldn't look away, almost as if I read the page over and over, then it would stop freaking me out so much.
My cynical conclusion is, wow, they're not even bothering to draw individual Morlocks at all anymore.
Well, I think it works. Now, Mimi is about to permanently absorb everybody that he's temporarily apparently absorbed. Like, if they stick with him for long enough, they become part of him permanently. So, Jean, not knowing what else to do, telepathically and permanently turns off his mind. And everyone falls out of him, and then he's just this small, weak, brain-dead individual. It's actually really sad, and we do get one of those tears running down the cheek that we see a lot in this era. But this time it's earned, because that's the thing, like the premise and some of the characterization in this arc doesn't really work, but many of the moments super, super fucking do. And this is one of them. Early 90s Jean Grey, as boring as she was in the cartoon, is great in the comic.
Yeah, she's really interesting here. And she's a character. And I think part of what turned people off of her as a character, unfortunately, is one of the things that I like best about her, which is her relationship to Professor Xavier and the way she's kind of liminal between the team and one of the teachers, basically. She very much reads as the kid who's been there longer, who knows the grownups, who sits at the grownups table, and no one's quite sure if she's a peer or an authority figure, and she's not quite sure either.
That's a good take on it, and I definitely agree. Now, in the fight, Bishop, since he can't shoot anyone, has been using his apparently slightly less lethal energy blasts, which come from when he absorbs energy.
Unfortunately, he has to get hit with energy on the regular to keep his own energy up, and he's run out.
So he totally Brer Rabbits the Morlocks. If even one of you possessed a bioblast, oh boy, would I be in trouble.
Someone get Monty! Monty has bioblasts!
No. Please. Mercy.
Of course, the cops choose just this moment to show up to arrest Bishop for his earlier murder spree.
Right in the middle of the melee. Guys, your timing is terrible.
And then they hit him right in the melee. Right in the middle of the melee.
Right? So he blows up their police car, just like the blue team did back in New Orleans to avoid getting pulled over. God, police cars are like the secondary enemy of the X-Men after the hatred and fear of humanity.
Okay, in all fairness, I think that's an entirely reasonable position, but the rate of escalation of force is a little bit ridiculous at this point.
That is Bishop's middle name.
So some of the X-Men, however, are still underground, most notably Archangel, who has tracked down the place where he lost his wings and falls to his knees to yell at the sky there, or at least at the tops of the sewers.
Hey, wait a minute. This is actually the place where he was not even nailed so much as gently hanged, draped, on the ceremonial dais by Callisto back in Uncanny X-Men number 170. This isn't where he was nailed to the wall by harpoons in the Mutant Massacre.
Although, you know, I feel like it's kind of reasonable at this point for him to mix up those two locations.
I guess. I mean, he does have very bad luck with the structural integrity of his wings down here in the Morlock tunnels, although it looked more uncomfortable and less agonizing the first time around.
Yeah, whatever they did to him the first time, it looked like he was hung up by something that pierced his wings, but it was not nearly so graphic, and he didn't seem to be particularly uncomfortable, and whatever it was obviously didn't do any permanent damage. So, different set of circumstances. Xavier is also exploring alone with his cool hover chair actually has headlights. It's a pretty rad vehicle for exploring a sewer, I gotta say.
Yeah, that panel of him going through with the headlights on all alone in his kind of like a safari jacket action team look, that's one of my iconic Xavier 90s panels right there.
I gotta say, one of the things I love about Rainey's Xavier, and that I love when people do with Xavier anyway, because I am entirely, entirely of the opinion that Xavier should be drawn ripped as hell.
I mean, we've seen it. He was working out all the time when he got his new body, but he also just works out his upper body a whole bunch, which I can see him totally doing.
Well, dude, I don't know how many manual wheelchair users you know, but just the fact of getting around, especially hilly areas in New England in one of those, he's going to have unbelievable shoulders already. But I mean, like he is already going to be disproportionately built as far as his shoulders and arms. And the fact that he works out on top of that. Yeah. Like Xavier should be super strong, not super strong, but impressive.
That seems entirely reasonable. I agree. But he has to exit his hover chair and use some of that upper body strength to get to a young Morlock he finds, who he realizes has the mutant power to link all the other Morlocks together and to project his own fear and panic onto them. That's why the Morlocks are tearing each other apart and or standing around idly, but let's not worry about that part right now. Apparently, the young Morlock's powers are also such that to help calm him down, Xavier's going to have to physically touch him. He drags himself along and snags on something. He thinks it's his pants and then realizes that he's partially impaled one of his legs. Another 90s theme. You remember that time Bishop got impaled by a pipe? It's
ew.
Pretty gross, but really compelling. And I like that. I like when you get these little real life things that feel just as threatening as all the super stuff going on. That's conveyed very well here.
So you mentioned in the notes that you don't get why so many people get impaled on pipes in the 90s. And I actually have a theory about that.
Shoot.
Which is that it's a fairly gruesome injury that can be drawn as an afterthought.
Oh, right, because you just sort of draw the pipe sticking out of the person.
Yeah, you just add the pipe.
Just add pipe for instant impalement. Listeners, I don't know how you could use that as advice, but don't, please.
Don't impale anyone. If you're drawing a comic and you need to seriously injure someone and you don't really want to have to keep careful track of how they're injured from panel to panel, then we recommend, you know, fictional in pencils pipe impaling.
But only then. Xavier does indeed free himself, and he makes it to this small, panicked Morlock child.
Now is a time for healing. Rest, child, and know you are forgiven.
I will really stand up for early 90s Xavier. I mean, not the Rudyard Kipling part, but his compassion and his strength of will really does come through. Like, he's a guy that I would look up to and trust.
And also might think he's God.
I mean, everyone's got their problems. But that's the thing, like, we're really hard on Xavier, and Xavier's more of a jerk in some eras and less of a jerk in other eras, and a lot of 90s Xavier is pretty fucking great. I mean, think about him talking to Scott and Jean in that fall set issue pre-wedding, like, his dynamic with the team, but also his dynamic with just this random kid he's never met. This is one of my favorite Xaviers.
Yeah, this is an Xavier who cares a lot, who is very much at the helm of the X-Men, but who's also sort of very much renegotiating his own identity in ways that for once I think go in a really positive direction. Often Xavier is at his best and his most sympathetic when he is working at ground level or below it, as in this case.
Speaking not of sympathetic people,
Mikhail Rasputin has decided that he is going to head out and, bring Callisto with him and join up with the Morlocks. And Iceman, who's the only one of the X-Men left back at the mansion, does his best to stop him, but he is no match for Mikhail.
You do not understand, child.
I spent an entire decade in total isolation, perfecting my mutant ability to channel all manner of energy, to transform matter from one state to another. Say, from ice to water!
Wait, I thought he'd spent most of that time being like the boozy Martha Stewart of non-Judgment War.
I think it was about 50-50, but yeah, that's exactly what he does. He turns Iceman into just water, which then scatters and melts all over the floor. Fuck!
He then turns Iceman into solid ice, and which he insists that Iceman could always, you know, have done, which I think we knew.
No, not at this point, actually. This is new information.
Well, there was the bit where Xavier used his fancy machine to give Iceman an ice form rather than a snow form. Was that supposed to be just a coating on him?
Yeah, that's always been the implication, kind of like in Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, when Iceman shoots ice all over himself, and then there's a block of ice, and then he shatters it, and then there's that great theme song, and there's a Waka Chica soundtrack, and I love Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
I'm glad it makes you so happy. Yeah, so Mikhail turns Iceman into solid ice and then shatters him. Whoops.
Now, the next stop on the Iceman You Have So Much Potential train is going to be in Uncanny X-Men 311. That's where Emma Frost takes over his body and starts doing even more ice stuff that he never realized he could. This is a continuing Iceman theme and fits his personality pretty well.
This looks pretty murdery, but don't worry. Mikhail Rasputin has decided that he is done with murder. He has killed more than enough people, and he's never going to be responsible for another death for at least, like, the next 5 pages.
So he turns Bobby back into his human form, telling Callisto exactly that. He can't bring himself to kill anyone. She replies,
"Really? We'll have to work on that."
At which point, Callisto goes to smash up Storm's attic apartment, plants included, so she can find the leadership vest that Storm took from her way back in their iconic duel for the leadership of the Morlocks.
Okay, it is a totally sweet vest, but why didn't you just start by looking in the fucking closet? Like, it's clearly not gonna be in the flower pots.
I mean, the Morlocks don't have a lot of creature comforts. Most of them probably don't have closets. Maybe some of them do keep their clothing in flower pots.
But they're clearly full of plants and dirt.
I mean, under the plants and dirt.
That's a terrible way to store clothing.
I didn't say it was a good way.
Now, this brings us to the final issue of the arc, Uncanny X-Men number 293, titled The Last Morlock Story. Spoiler, it is not.
This is written again by Scott Lobdell, with breakdowns by Rurik Tyler, pencils by Tom Rainey, and inks by Joe Rubinstein.
Below ground, Storm, Colossus, and Bishop discover that Mikhail has shown up, and in fact, he has gathered the surviving Morlocks below the city and has apparently decided to rule them. Hey, speaking of which, do you remember the time that Wilson Fisk became king of a different group of New York City sewer dwellers? Because that was definitely a thing that happened in Daredevil.
No, I'm just thinking of the Rat King from Ninja Turtles and how cool his action figure was, but it was never painted quite right. So like some of the rats were just painted the same color as his rags, and that always made me a little sad.
Okay, so when you say Rat King, I mean, normally Rat King is like, that's such like a big amorphous ball of rats intertangled with one another, right?
I mean, that would have been way creepier, but no, he was just a dude. I think he could like control rats with a pipe or something, or maybe I'm thinking of that one Morlock. I don't know.
You might be thinking of the Pied Piper of myth and also Flash villainy.
No. I mean, that's the guy that the Piper from the Morlocks was based on, clearly.
Okay, sure. Did he have a crown, the Rat King? Did he have, like, a crown made of rats?
No, he just had a lot of bandages and rags, and also rats.
Okay, because a crown made of rats would actually be super cool.
And I bet the rats would consider that, like, a great big honor, because he was their king, right? And so if you get to be the symbol of your king's rulership, like, that's got to be the best day you ever had.
And also they'd get to, like, nest in his hair and just hang out. Like, that would be the posh job.
Oh, man. The Rat King is so much more endearing now, or at least his rats are.
Okay, rats are awesome, dude.
I'm not denying that.
And I admittedly, I have not and will not closely approach any of the, you know, ones that randomly show up in the subways and sewers of New York, but I have seen some subway ones and they were pretty cute.
Excellent, excellent. Meanwhile, in the fictional subways / sewers.
Right, Mikhail has a plan. For now that he is leader of the Morlocks, he has decided they're going to commit mass suicide by drowning.
I I hate that plan. That's like the worst possible plan.
It's a terrible plan. And Mikhail Rasputin, less than one full issue after declaring that he could never kill anyone else again, has used his power to open all the floodgates, and the East River is on its way in.
Callisto, meanwhile, goes and finds Professor Xavier to start a fight for some reason.
Oh, no, she's got a reason. It's just a nonsense reason. The time has come for the true leader of the Morlocks to battle the founder of the X-Men. To the death.
But it turns out it's just to the really effective uppercut, as Xavier uses his aforementioned amazing upper body strength to deck the hell out of her.
However, speaking of death, Jean finds Warren on his knees yelling about his feelings and gives him a fantastic talking to in what is one of my hands-down favorite scenes of this entire story. Like, if the arc were just this scene, I'd be more okay with it.
Warren, still on his knees and in psychological anguish, begins.
I'm warning you, Jean. Go away, or I won't be responsible.
You'd like to believe that, wouldn't you?
Huh?
How easy it'd be to let your wings take the blame for all your dirty work.
Don't patronize me! You have no idea what it's like to have your entire life pulled out from under you.
Warren, please. You're talking to a woman who's been killed, cloned, and kidnapped more times than I can remember. Let's keep it in perspective.
You're right. I don't know what came over me.
Nothing.
What?
Nothing came over you. I never said anything before because I wasn't sure you were emotionally prepared to hear it. But now it's come to this, alternating bouts of depression and rage, you abandoning the team in the middle of combat, the acts of fury and destruction caused by your wings, the ones you so desperately seek to disclaim, are your own. Apocalypse only gave you the tools with which to destroy your life, Warren. He provided the instruments of pain and suffering. You're the one responsible for wielding them. I don't think I'm telling you anything you haven't suspected for a while. You don't suffer from a bloodlust. You're responsible for every act you commit. Apocalypse took one night away. What you do with the rest of your life is up to you.
Oh, snap.
Right? I mean, this is a big goddamn deal. On the one hand, it doesn't fully make sense. I mean, we did see Archangel's wings while he was unconscious actually killing dudes just a few issues ago. But it's a ballsy plot move. I mean, this character's entire angst was self-inflicted. He's been blaming this external thing for what he's been doing? Ha ha ha.
Ooh, I can no-prize this.
Do it.
Well, so the wings reflect his thoughts and feelings, right? They're part of his body.
Okay.
You know how, like, sometimes dogs run and hunt in their sleep?
He was murdering in his sleep?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, that actually does kind of work, but let's talk about this. What do you think about this revelation? Because this does fundamentally change Archangel as we know him. This is new since the first time we saw him with those metal wings way back in the Fall of the Mutants.
I really like this. I think it makes him a lot more interesting, and I think it gives him significantly more agency and significantly more of a character arc here. We've seen him trying to shake off Apocalypse's influence, but the state he was in when Apocalypse found him, the things that he voluntarily went with. Like, this kind of makes sense to me, that it was just that massive a breakdown, and he can't quite acknowledge it.
Yeah, as retcons go, I think this is a good one, because this one feels emotionally true, and I dig that. And also, I mean, you don't have to do much mental gymnastics to justify it. It's not like, oh, Jean was at the bottom of Jamaica Bay. It's like, oh no, you were lying to yourself. Actually, your problems are way deeper than you thought, and you need to actually address them. And I like that it comes from Jean. I like that Jean is the one to say, Warren, this is something you don't want to hear, but I feel like I have to tell you, and I am here for you, and we are here for you. But dude, you have got to fucking get over this.
Yeah, Jean is a really good person to be giving get the fuck over yourself talks at this point, considering, like, I feel like she's still kind of in the having come back from the dead, fuck all y'all mode, which I really love. It's something that I loved early in X-Factor. It's something that I love here. What I don't love on this page, and I think it's a really good page otherwise, are Jean's breasts, which are really anatomically distressing.
Yeah. Well, it is the 90s. These things happen.
Like, that's just, there's no... That doesn't even make sense.
you know.
It's like someone just sort of took, I don't even know what object it would be required for this, and just sort of stuck them to the front of her costume. And I want to know how artists of this era thought breasts worked.
Mikhail, or maybe a Morlock, it's unclear, teleports Xavier and Callisto into the main sewer so that Callisto can die with him. I guess she's sort of his queen in the twisted way he's looking at the world now.
Yeah, he's decided that they're soulmates, that only they can possibly understand each other. She's unconscious at this point, by the way, and for the entire rest of the issue, which makes everything just that much worse. And Mikhail is going on about things like putting these poor, pitiful creatures out of their misery. And I hate this comic so much. I hate how every single character in this comic talks about the Morlocks, and God.
Well, there's a big fight as all the good guys and the bad guys end up in the same room at the same time, and everybody fights everybody except the Morlocks, who just sort of, you know, hang out.
And despite their best efforts, the X-Men can't entirely beat Mikhail, and they can't figure out a way to stop the flood. So Mikhail manages to sort of magically, telekinetically, nebulous mutant powersly push all of the X-Men out. And I guess all the Morlocks just fucking die. Wait, no, they don't actually. They don't. Because years later, it's gonna turn out that they were all transported to another dimension, because now it's fucking Dragon Ball Z in here.
Oh, right. Do you remember that time when Goku died and he went to hell, except they couldn't say hell in the American version, and so all the sweatshirts of everybody in hell said H-F-I-L, which you could easily edit, and it was the home for infinite losers? I loved that.
While I've never actually seen Dragon Ball Z, I do remember being told about that scene multiple times, so I sort of remember it.
I think that pretty much counts.
I remember other people's, you know, recaps of it.
But yeah, he has teleported them all, apparently, and this is totally a retcon. I can't imagine this was the intention at this point. Another dimension, probably one with good vineyards, I assume.
It's called The Hill.
Okay, so it's a hill. There are vineyards on a hill. I'll buy that, you know, give it...
We did a cold open about it once.
I can't be expected to remember everything we talk about. Yeah, you're totally right, we did. But some of these Morlocks will eventually come back from The Hill as the violent mutant group Gene Nation.
At which point Storm will rip Marrow's heart out.
Bringing it all full circle. Hooray! But, oh man, Colossus, I am so sorry. You just had to watch your sister get de-aged after she sacrificed herself in Inferno, and then you were happy as an artist in America for a little while, and then that didn't work, and now your brother's died. I really hope nothing tragic happens to you or your family anytime soon. That might be one straw too many.
Damn, Miles.
Seriously. But that's the thing. Colossus is being slowly broken down in this era, and it sucks to see because he's such a good guy, but it makes for some wonderful story fodder.
He's been being slowly broken down for a lot longer than this era. I mean, Colossus is, I think, in a lot of ways, one of the X-Men's greatest slow burn tragedies.
When would you mark the beginning of that decline?
Probably around the time the X around Dallas. When the X-Men break off from everything, and he is completely cut off from all of the people he's closest to, he has to fake dead, and specifically he realizes and can't intervene with Illyana's descent.
For me, I think I might go back even further to when he had to kill Proteus.
Oh, good call. Yeah, no, I think you're right.
It's actually going to culminate in a really interesting way. Eventually, Colossus is going to leave the team and join the Acolytes just to find some kind of a higher purpose, to get away from the series of tragedies that have broken him. And that might seem out of character, but honestly, I think that story point is really earned.
And everyone will be too distracted to care because Wolverine just got his skeleton ripped out.
To be fair, that does also suck a great deal.
He gets better. Just to screw that in a little tighter, we get a bit of an epilogue where Colossus has to call home and explain to his sister that they're not going to have a fun visit after all.
Illyana, this is Piotr. I'm afraid I will not be returning home tomorrow as planned. Something has happened. Yes, something like saving the world. What was the surprise I promised? We'll talk about it when I get home. I love you too, Snowflake. Das Vidania.
Ooh.
And then Jean just silently holds him as he slumped over, and It's a really, really effective scene. This arc is a mess in so many ways, but those good moments, those are the moments I really like to focus on. Those are the moments I really like to hold in my heart, because this is the era that in many ways was my X-Men. And that's what you have to do when the comics that are coming out, when they do something's right and something's wrong, they're what you have if they're what you love. And so you find the parts that work, and stuff like this really works.
Well, stuff like this scene really works.
That's exactly what I meant. This scene in particular, this glorious tragedy in particular.
Yeah, there are great scenes. I just really wish that the larger arc they were part of had remotely lived up to them, because, ooh boy.
I hear ya.
Now, on that cheerful note, you've got questions.
Robin asks via email, are you subject to any copyright laws in your discussion of Marvel content or use of the pictures in the As Mentioned section?
Robin, that is an awesome question, and it's also an awesome opportunity to talk about a concept I am super into, and that is fair use. So copyright laws basically say you can't republish copyrighted material. What you can do is use it as illustrative of critical discussion, which is what we're doing here. You notice we never ever reproduce entire issues. We rarely even put up entire scenes. We just have brief glimpses into the books or descriptions of them, as we're giving here, that illustrate things that otherwise that you need to fully, you know, understand what the critical discussion is. So fair use covers that. Fair use also covers transformative works, which this falls under the very general umbrella of academic papers also would too. And I should have qualified earlier. I am not a lawyer or any kind of legal professional. I'm just a huge nerd about this stuff. We do have a really kick-ass lawyer who we talked all of this through when we started the podcast. And if you are interested in doing similar work, we recommend her very highly. She specializes in working with independent creators and especially folks in connected to the comics industry. And we'll totally link to her contact info in the as mentioned. But basically, you want to avoid doing things that reproduce a work. You can talk about it, and you can use tiny bits of it to, again, illustrate that discussion or to show things that aren't quite describable. For example, we use the visual companion to show you moments that you can't quite get just from textual or audio description. But other than that, we're all original content, and that's how fair use works, and it's super cool.
Yay, fair use.
And there are some great bloggers and folks online who talk a lot about copyright and intellectual property law and how it interacts with transformative works and things like fan fiction. And again, I'll link to some of those in the As Mentioned for this episode, because they're really cool. And if you're at all interested in this stuff or doing any kind of work that falls under that transformative umbrella, it's well worth reading up on. All right, let's see. Polyhedral Princess asks on Tumblr, Jay, do you have any trans/LGBT headcanons you latch onto? And to both of you, which X-Men member has the best beard, specifically facial hair?
Oh, man. Okay, I'm going to start here. Facial hair, as longtime listeners or even short-time listeners or just people who've seen a picture of me lately know, is one of my favorite topics. I really enjoy facial hair. So as far as narrowing it down with mutants, I'm glad you specified facial hair and not beards, because there actually aren't that many beards, but there are lots of other things. So I'm going to start out by saying not Ultimate/Morrison-era Soul Patch Logan. That was not a good look, Logan. I don't know why you did that in the Ultimate Universe and then why you brought it over to the 616. Bad plan.
Miles, I think the facial hair disambiguation was to distinguish between beards as in facial hair or beards as in the colloquial use of a woman who pretends to be romantically engaged with a gay man so that he can remain closeted.
Ah, well, that's an entirely different question. Perhaps we can think about that for another time. But for now, as far as things that work, you know, Soul Patches, Adam X has one a lot of the time when he's drawn. He wears it a lot better than Logan does. I think it's just more believable. Nightcrawler's beard, somewhat in Extraordinary X-Men a couple of years ago and very much in the current X-Men Red, is great. That dude is legit sexy with a full beard.
I also want to give a shout out to Nightcrawler's piratical goatee in The Age of Apocalypse, which he also wore excellently.
Speaking of goatees, or actually technically Van Dyke's, because a goatee is just the chin part and the whole thing with a mustache is a Van Dyke. Anyway, Bishop, I've never been able to get that look to work myself. I think my facial hair just doesn't grow in evenly enough to make it happen, but Bishop rocks it. Maybe if I'd had a big mullet, or a bandana, or a shotgun I went everywhere with.
He just comes from a future with better beards, man.
That's probably it. Yeah, they gotta compensate for the shitty everything else. I really like Forge's small, neat mustache. It looks good with his ponytail. I also like the similar mustaches that Richter and Shatterstar were recently seen wearing in Secret Warriors. So good. I guess Banshee's sideburns would count as facial hair. They should if they don't. They're just so flowing and carefree. Like, Logan's sideburns are pretty good too, but Banshee's are better. Of course we have Corsair's astonishingly 70s, like, cop stash. I feel like the sexual power of that entire decade just lives in that mustache, waiting to come out. That's why Hepzibah sticks around. I mean, that and a number of reasons. Then we have, in honor of this episode, not exactly an X-Man, but Healer, the Morlock sewer wizard who just died. That beard gave him extra spell slots, and he could, like, keep stuff in it. And then this is more of an ex-villain, but Roughhouse's beard, you know, from, like, the Wolverine ongoing, it's just so full and luxurious. I wish I could have a beard like that. And I do want to give a special non-X mention to that time in the 60s that the Thing went back in time and became Blackbeard. His beard, while fake, is perfection. And also, he was just in Exiles from that time period in the latest issue, and it was really fun.
Okay. I hear you, Miles. I hear you on all of this. But first of all, future Wizard Iceman.
Good point.
And second, Colossus.
Oh, yeah, from the Extraordinary X-Men era. Yeah, that actually may be one of the best X-beards out there.
He rocks that beard so hard.
Yeah, X-Men creators, you should totally bring that back. It was a great look. Maybe just in time for his wedding, which I think is kind of a strange story decision, but would be better with a beard.
Okay, I'm going to avoid any of the obvious jokes and go back to the first part of the question about trans and queer headcanons. So my relationship to headcanon is complicated, and it's further complicated by brainwiring stuff. And a lot of the time, it's less an overlay over continuity than me playing what-if games in my own head that don't actually significantly affect the ways that I interpret or read the canonical comics. However, I've decided that headcanon can be political as well as personal, so it doesn't really matter whether I read it that way. Now, I'm going to use the power given to me by my expertise and my role as host of a moderately successful podcast to say that if you have a trans or queer X-Men headcanon, it is now officially true and valid and real. The X-Men are just queer and trans as all fuck. Seriously, though, in terms of what I would just overlay into the 616, I thought that Storm being queer was canon for a long time, so that probably counts. Ditto Kitty, and I gotta say I have trouble imagining a timeline where Quentin Quire is entirely satisfied with binary gender.
Legit. We are a fully listener-supported podcast, and some levels of support come with acknowledgement on air from a variety of fictional concepts and characters. Let's just do one from the angry Claremontian narrator.
Ah, Ross Mandan. All you wanted was a pleasant family vacation and maybe some minor exoneration for your past crimes. And then Joe Salvatore had to go and ruin everything. Again. Nice one, Joe.
And with that,
Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is recorded in Forest Hills, New York and Portland, Oregon and produced by Matt Hunter.
New episodes come out Sundays on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and lots of other podcatchers, and at explainthexmen.com.
Check out explainthexmen.com for all kinds of extra content, including visual companions to every episode.
Our show is 100% listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air and gloriously ad-free, check out the Patreon link at the top of explainthexmen.com.
Next week, I will be away from the studio, traveling through scenic Latveria.
But I am very excited to be joined by Hub of the excellent podcast Tighten Up the Defense to head back to the Bronze Age for some space nights, and also for that time Captain America and Magneto fought over the tiniest man in the world.